So I'm Mark Quinn. I'm 61, and I was I started in Southside Radio in Bray when I was about 20, and I then moved on to BLB, Bray Local Broadcasting, and ever since then I've had a career in television post-production and production.
Cool. I'm Michael Gray. I'm 55, and I was involved with BLB Radio. Started when I was about 18, and was involved in a number of programs, from production to presenting, kids programs, rhythm and blues.
Doug Bell Maguire. Like Mark, I started on Southside Radio. Got a phone call from Mark way back in 1977 saying, hey, would you like to be on a radio station? So that's how it started. Went with Mark from Southside, helped found BLB Radio, which went on to become East Coast today. Was involved in music programs and magazine programs like Roundabout and Lunchtime Look Around, and was involved for 11, 12 years. I'm now 60, so that's it. Yeah.
Cool. So can you tell us a bit about the split from South Coast into BLB and what year BLB began?
Okay, the Southside, when it started, you got to remember the landscape then. There was no other music stations in Ireland. There were none. The only music stations you had were from overseas, Radio Luxembourg and BBC Radio 1, which was really bad received really badly over here. So we arrived on the scene, and I was a DJ. I had been DJing before that, so I got asked, would I like to work on this radio station?
Yeah.
Didn't know anything about radio. And figured, well, it'd be the same as playing records at a disco, yeah? But it wasn't. It was a different kettle of fish, and I learned that fairly quickly, that you do need to talk between each record, and you don't need to shout. You're not trying to encourage people to dance. You're just actually talking to them over this radio. And it was hugely popular, especially with kids. It was massively popular. It was incredible. Everybody was listening to it. And I'd get stopped in the street and asked to play requests, and it was absolutely phenomenal. So we had a kind of a mini fame, if you like, in Bray. Lots of school kids playing requests and stuff, which was a bit kind of low level in terms of the intelligence. We weren't appealing to an older audience. So a few of us felt, well, we need to kind of inject a little bit more talk into this and make it a little bit more appealing to an older audience. Because you remember, if you won't remember, but at the time, Gay Byrne would have been hugely popular on RTE radio, and his program was predominantly about talk. Now, we didn't have anyone with his kind of skills, but nonetheless, we felt we could do interviews with local people and try and inject a bit more talk. But the guy who'd set up the station, Southside, who invited me on as the head DJ, his name was Paul, his stage name as it were, or his DJ name was Paul Nicholas. And Andrew Coffey, I knew him as a local, and he became Andy Ruan as a TV presenter on RTE. He wanted to just stick with the pop music. He wasn't happy with us, this notion of us doing talk shows. So one day he just took his transmitter, and that was the end of that. So Southside was off the air.
Right.
And it was all over the local papers. There was a split, a policy split. So I was interviewed, and I was kind of seen as the figurehead of the people who wanted to do more talk stuff. And he was seen as the figurehead of the music, kind of, which is the truth.
Yeah.
And so he went off and set up Southside elsewhere, I think in the Victor Hotel in Rochestown Avenue. By then, there were more pirate stations popping up in Dublin, like Radio Dublin was on air and a couple of other ones. And, you know, there was money to be made because you could sell advertising, you know. So we set up BLB. It took us about 4 months to get on air. So we set up on the 22nd of August, 1979, we opened. And we, from the get-go, we said, we're going to have more wide-ranging programs, we're going to try and appeal to an older audience and so on. And it was a brave decision at the time, because the money was where the music was, basically, So that's essentially what happened, and I was the station manager for the first 2 years or so, because I was the only one that didn't have a job, so I was free during the day. So I remember famously I mixed the first 3 weeks programs all day. I didn't get a break until 6:30 in the evening, because none of the DJs that were on, because they were older, because we were trying to appeal to an older audience, none of them could mix. So I was the one, so sitting there eating sandwiches and mixing all the music and the chat.
So in those 4 months before you got set up, was it trying to hunt down and track a transmitter to get going?
Yes, yeah.
How did you get one, and was it?
My memory's a bit patchy on this, but I seem to remember we somehow or other, through one of the guys who put money into the station, there were six guys who put money, I could name them all now, but maybe I shouldn't embarrass them, but they all put in 100 quid each. That'll give you the measure of how little in today's money that one needed. And one of them worked in Sony. He was he was fairly high up in Sony, and I think he knew a technical guy. And this guy, who was a bit of a nutty professor, built a transmitter for us. He was in Stillorgan. Paul Cotter was his name, and he arrived out with this really weird looking thing, which looked like it was from, you know, the Second World War. It looked like something that they were using in to seek German spy planes or whatever, and all sorts of dials on it and valves and everything. And it was a medium wave transmitter, and we were on 360 meters on the medium wave, and so we were only really. You can only really pick us up in Bray, the Bray area.
Yeah.
Whereas Southside had a much bigger transmitter.
Yeah.
And they were out in Rochestown Avenue. So, so the technology was, it was two decks, a mixer, a microphone, one microphone, that's all we had, and a set of headphones, and that was it, you know?
Yeah. And how many hours would you have done a week?
Okay, so when the station started, first it was on from 11 in the morning till 11 at night.
Yeah. Wow. That would have been pretty hefty for this one.
My memory of it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. It was. We didn't do right through. We stopped at 11.
11 in the morning to 11 at night. Yeah. And then eventually we started opening earlier and so on. And actually, Joe Bollard was the first presenter on each day.
Yeah.
And Joe would have been about 15 years older than me then. So I was 20 or 21. And he was about 35 or whatever.
Yeah.
And he was blind. So I have obviously had to mix for him, and from the get-go he said, you're going to have to teach me how to mix. And within a matter of I think about 6 weeks, I taught Joe how to mix. So it meant I could stay in bed. He could open the station every morning. And that's the truth. He used to go down and mix. Incredibly, he had Braille on his records, so he knew which side of the album it was.
Would he have done the Braille himself, or could you buy records of Braille?
He had to buy stickers and put them on. His wife put them on for him.
That's right. And he did the whole show himself.
He was our gay born.
He was our gay born. Yeah. He was great, Joe. He was great. Yeah.
Very, very popular. And he was super.
Mm. Yeah. And in terms of advertising, how would you have done on that scale? Was there enough of a listenership to make a bit of money off?
Absolutely.
Excuse me,
because we're appealing to a local audience, and because we were seen very much as Bray, a lot of the businesses in Bray supported us. Because they were getting it at home. I presume business owners would hear from their wife, I was listening to Joe Bollard today, it's great, that station's great, blah blah blah. So that, you know, clothes shops, butchers, you know, and I've got loads of tapes at home of the ads, old ads, you know, that we used to do. Hilarious, some of the stuff was great. But they kept the station going, basically. You know, their funding, you know.
And talk show, would you have been interviewing Bray locals? Bring them on?
We did, we used to have on a Saturday. Weekends was mainly the time for the, let's say, the magazine-type talk show programmes.
Yeah.
And we'd have current affairs, whatever was happening in the North Wicklow area at the time. And we'd bring individuals on, we'd interview them. As the station developed, we got more equipment, and we moved from where we had started off, which was just one room, to getting almost like a ground floor in a building on Galton.
Before that, we went to above the Dug Inn, where we had a purpose-built studio. We had a reception with two studios, and we were there for a couple of years before we went to Galton.
That's right, yeah.
And we used to have the studio in one half, and then we'd have the interviewers or the interviewees in the other studio, and we'd have mics on a table, and one person would be doing the mixing, and other people in the other room doing the questions and what have you. So we did that. We would cover the local elections. We'd cover events happening in North Wicklow, Bray, Greystones, elsewhere. Anybody that was visiting, if we could get them in. Yeah, it was all kinds of stuff.
And we always from the get-go wanted to be as professional as we could be, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and Doug and I actually, we did a training course, like I'm going back a bit now, but we did a training course fairly early on in the communication center in Booterstown. It was only a week long thing, but some of the techniques that we learned, I'm still using them to this day, you know? I mean, it's incredible, you know, just the very basics of editing and how things should sound, and the microphone techniques and all that kind of stuff. And so we had a fairly and good culture of buying, reinvesting the money that we did make and buying really good equipment. Like, we had good headphones and, didn't we? And good microphones and everything. It was great, you know.
And then we got the LS-A28 mixer.
Yeah, the Alice, yeah, lovely desk, yeah.
Yeah. And we got outside broadcasting equipment for taking out to football matches and stuff like that, and recording or doing vox pops on the street and then coming back to the studio. Mixing them, splicing them, putting them together.
Yeah.
We did all this. This was years and years ago, way before.
But we were also doing live outside broadcasts as well.
That's right.
When we had the caravan.
Yeah.
Yes.
We ironically had a guy who joined the station. Who was a very quiet guy and didn't really want to be on air. But he was a really good technician, and he subsequently became a guard. So he had a guard working for an illegal radio station as our technician, and he built us an FM transmitter. So he got us on FM in stereo, which at the time was like, whoa, this is great. So we used the FM as a link back to the studio. So we'd have two FM transmitters, one which was broadcasting the station, and then he built a second one, which meant that we could bring a caravan to anywhere in Bray, and then beam that FM signal back to the station and then rebroadcast it. Like, it was simple technology, but it worked really well. So that meant that live on air, Doug could be in the studio and he could talk to me.
Yeah,
I'd be out in the street or vice versa, and I'd hear him over the air, and I'd go, oh yeah, Doug, I'm here with such and such, bam, bam, bam. Okay, and then he'd open the fader and I'd talk on air. It was great.
This is back in what, the 70s?
Yeah,
early 80s.
Early 80s.
Early 80s. High tech for the era.
And there was something on it for everyone. It didn't matter what kind of music you were into.
Right.
There was everything was covered.
Yeah.
Everything.
Sport, rock and roll, country,
Irish.
Jazz, blues, and classical.
Yeah.
Everything was covered.
Yeah. We were a bit too ambitious, really, in ways, you know.
Yeah, because it seems very ambitious and a big operation for something that was illegal. I was just going, how did you maintain not getting blocked or raided? The guard.
We were never raided.
Never raided.
Never.
No.
Because a lot of the other people I've been talking to, there was a bit more of a. It seems like you have had less paranoia than they might have had.
I think that was due to our location, because the ones in Dublin City, they seem to draw a lot more attention to themselves. We were kind of where we were, we were kind of left
under
alone.
The radar,
really.
I think also as well because of the nature of the station, like we sold ourselves on air as a community station. We kept using the word community,
and then you got community on your side.
Exactly, and it was quite clever. I mean, it was political, I suppose, but clever, but it worked for the local politicians. Loved coming on the station because obviously they could talk directly to their to their audience, to their prospective electorate, as it were.
And we had delegations. Remember, we had one or two delegations came over from the UK to see how we were running a community radio, because they were going to start community radio in the UK, but they couldn't go on air because their laws were much, let's say, more strict than ours at the time. So they came over to see how we did it. They took notes, they met us, they asked how we put it together, then they went back to the UK. And a couple of years later, lo and behold, they had community radio. Based and having visited us, Waterford local radio was the same. They came out to us to see how we did it, and they set up WLR based on the model that we were putting together.
Yeah,
we weren't going for the let's say the high end advertising market at the time. We knew once it became legal, the income would come in, but we had a different model.
Yeah.
And we were aiming at a different market. And for a lot of years, it was very, very successful, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
So did you go all the way till 88 or did it end before then?
When did it close?
We had to close because of the.
Well, they gave notice. They were going
law
to.
Law came in,
At 88.
I think it was 88,
And were you broadcasting right up until that final
match? Yeah, his was the last voice.
Mine was the last voice. I opened the station back in, was it 79?
79, yeah.
I did the first thing, hello, welcome to this is BLB, Bray Local Broadcasting, etc. And then I finished the station in 1988 at mine. Mark and I put a speech together. It was the very last thing that went out on air, and then we just hit the button, and that was it.
And the reason why was because we wanted to comply with the law, because we were going to apply for a license.
Yeah.
And you know, we got our license basically, which became Horizon originally, and it's now called East Coast. Which is a totally different beast from what we had seen. But none of us are involved. You know, none of us are involved in what it is now.
Yeah.
Which is a pity, really, because you know.
You built it from the start.
We built it from the start, which there you go.
But what happened was when it became legal, or was on the verge of becoming legal, then you got all people from the background with money and etc., and they started delicately muscling in
and becoming more commercial. Less
correct, correct. And all of the people who had been involved from the early days and had learned it and grown it
were pushed to the side.
Yes. Yes,
and that's a shame. What
But we had a lot of fun for 11 years.
Yeah, we did.
We made no money, none.
No,
don't let anyone tell you we made nothing. Cost us a fortune, but we had fun, and it was. And we can say we did it. Yeah. And we never ever. I know it's called pirate radio here. We never considered ourselves pirates.
No,
never.
True,
We were a community radio.
Yeah,
and we always we never hid anything. And we never ever, as I say, never got raided and never had any trouble with anyone, ever, did we?
No, that's true, yeah.
We didn't. I was working at the time, and the place where I was working used to listen to the radio station, so I used to get time off from work to go and do my show,
yeah,
and then go back to work.
Is that right?
Yeah, never a problem.
I don't know if that anyone else would have a similar experience in a small town like you do. It seemed like the whole town was really... on your back, yeah.
Yeah, I think because I think a lot of the other stations around the country were owned by, you know, some businessman or businesses, as it were, and they were money making. They were unashamedly money, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know.
No.
But I suppose we took, I think, a harder road, to be honest. I mean, you know, when you think about it nowadays, if you wanted to put on a classical show, you'd say, well, let's not take 3 hours out of our schedule and turn what is usually a pop station into a classical station. Let's just open another station, you know, because it's so easy to do that now. But back then we were trying to, you know, be all things to all men, and it was very ambitious, and, you know, we didn't always hit the mark, and, you know, a lot of the time the presenters, it went from very good presenters to very, you know, weaker presenters. It wouldn't have survived in a commercial thing, because the commercial environment was all about making money. So in a way they were a bit soulless, and they were all a bit the same. I felt you might as well be listening to Sunshine as listening to Nova. They're all the same.
Yeah.
The same DJs, same voice, the same music, etc., etc. Whereas we were clearly from Bray, and, you know, we had local accents on and so on. And as I say, it was patchy.
And you had different music. You could have, you know, on a Sunday there would be classical music. Late night there would be rock. There would be garage music. There would be the pops, the top 20. Mm. So we covered the same, but we just did it differently. And then interspersed it with local events and activities, covering football matches, GAA matches, whatever it was. And it grew. I remember when Bray, whatever you call them, in the Carlisle ground set up again, and Joe Bollard used to follow them. He was about the only one at the time.
Yeah.
And then we ended up covering some of their football matches and
Bray Wanderers.
And things like that. It was fun. It was good.
And we had a kids show, and it was presented by kids.
Yes.
That's right.
No way.
Yeah. Yes. There was Uncle Bob, he was the anchor, but all the other segments and all was all done by kids.
And would that have been completely new in terms of radio in Ireland?
I think so, yeah. I don't think anyone else has ever done that like that.
I think it was. Wow. Actually, a lot of the stuff we did was kind of...
first.
Yeah, innovative in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I say, it was patchy, you know. Like,
it gives it more of a local flavour.
Yeah,
you don't want
sometimes it's a bit hard to listen to be honest, because, you know, you kind of go, oh, you know, like you could turn on and be slicker on the other stations.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So, but that also had a charm as well.
Exactly,
you know, so. But, it was, as Doug says, we had good fun, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
but you would hear music on their station that you wouldn't hear anywhere else.
That's true, yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
very true.
Yeah. You'd have a dedicated reggae show or blues show or someone playing American psychedelic music. You wouldn't hear that anywhere else, but... you got it on Airshop.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And did all of you have different shows that you did yourself, or did you team up with different people and you'd present?
Bit
shows?
Of both.
Yeah, yeah.
Doug and I worked together a good bit, and then and then we'd have separate shows as well.
Yeah, yeah.
We were very strong on producers. I should mention a friend of ours, Shea Byrne, who's also one of the founding members. He unfortunately is dead, but he had a rock show. Like, he was into kind of, you know, rock music. And he fostered this whole idea of bringing in guest producers. So he'd have guys in, and he'd be playing music that he wouldn't necessarily know much about, but they knew all about it, and they were full of enthusiasm. Now, they wouldn't go on air; they would just they'd supply the music.
Yeah.
They'd say, okay, let's play, I don't know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and all this kind of stuff.
They just bring the record collection. Yeah, it was brilliant.
You know. So, and that, of course, their friend. You know, there's obviously people listening to this kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, here again, you've got to remember the time. There was no Spotify. There was no internet. You know, there's no access to this music. The only way you got it was through, if you borrowed an album off some of the guy, or some guy in school said, have you heard this, or you know, this kind of thing.
Or
so
make you a tape.
Or make you a tape, exactly. But Shea was great. He used to cover local bands, interview local bands in the Mississippi rooms in Bray. There was music every night, live music every night. Well, we were spoiled, you know. It was absolutely brilliant, you know, great bands.
And we used to even go out and record bands playing live. I remember with Alwyn going to a hotel to record Rob Strong.
Sportsman. Probably was it the Sportsman?
No, it was on the one in Sulorgan. I can't think of the name of the hotel there.
Okay.
But we went, we set up the little mixing desk and put up cross mics and recorded Rob Strong. Then came back and played it live on air.
Yeah, it's great, isn't
then
it?
Then about Jim? 6 months later, he releases his live album.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, that was great. It's great. Some mad stories as well.
Mm. Yeah, go on. If you have any stories that come off the top of your head, that'd be
I don't know if you can tell this one, but anyway, Shay won't mind because he's not with us. But Shay was so drunk and stoned one night that it was a late night show that I arrived in, and he was on air and he was just playing back to back music. What's Shay doing? So I arrive up at the station. See, here again, no mobile phones, you know. And we'd no phone in the station. I arrive up and Shay is just incapable of speech, just about. So I said, here, lie on the floor, sort yourself out, and I'll mix for you. So he'd lie on the floor and I'd say, okay, the next one is Roxy Music or whatever. Okay. And he'd just lie there and go, okay, that was the Rolling Stones, and now this is Roxy Music. And it's on the bed. That's one mad story. Unbroadcastable, probably. But anyway.
I remember playing late night and putting on a Frank Zappa track that was about 23 minutes long, going around to the Mayfair and having a pint. And they're listening to it as well. So, yeah, about 5 minutes, right, going back around.
That's great.
Mad stuff.
That's great. Go on, Doug, you must have a mad story.
About
somebody else.
I can't remember. There was some crazy things happened.
There was one guy actually in the station, Joe Ballard, the blind guy. Here again, he won't mind me telling this story because it's great. I won't mention any names. But anyway, there was one guy in the station who, let's say, wasn't very popular, right? And when you're blind, I gather your other senses are heightened, you know. So he kind of knew, he'd know by someone's walk if they were in the studio, because he never, when he was on air, he'd have the headphones on, but he'd only have one headphone on, because if both on, both ears covered, he'd be disoriented. Mm. So he'd always have one ear off. And this guy came into the studio. I was mixing for Joe. Joe was there with his headphones on, and he came up behind Joe, snuck up behind. You should never do this to a blind person, but anyway, this creep did, and he came up behind him and said shh to me, right, and put his hands on Joe's shoulders. Joe knew who it was, knew he'd been in the room 5 minutes before, jumped up and went, I can see.
Brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant.
Anyway,
there was one late evening I was doing a music program, and two nameless individuals came in, and they were sitting opposite, very quiet, but they were smoking. And it wasn't quite a cigarette, they were smoking. And I never ever touched the stuff, ever. But that night I inhaled an awful lot, and I was on air, and I remember saying, opening the mic and saying, well, a bad workman always blames his tools, and I'm very sorry for making a mess of that last record, but I've got two of the biggest tools you've ever seen in the studio. And then I just corpsed, and I could not. I was about 6 minutes laughing my head off and trying to mix music and go in, and I was as high as a kite. And I never touched the stuff. But that's the kind of daft things that happened. Oh yeah, yeah. Happy days. Yeah. And I mean, it was lots of things.
I mean, just think back. We had a lot of women presenters as well, which was unusual.
Did. Yeah, true.
Absolutely. At the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Karen.
Sally.
Sally.
Alwyn.
Yeah. There was loads of others. But
Phyllis Hennessy. She used to do the classical.
Hilda.
Yes. Hilda.
Hilda, yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There are a lot of. And actually, just another thing that occurred to me as well. As we started to get more advertising in, and we only had one studio, remember, the on-air studio, we had to make ads. So they had to be made after the station went off air. So we decided we'd close earlier for a period, and just because we had this backlog of ads to do. So we closed at 8 o'clock in the evening, and I was doing the production on the ads at the time. So I arrived down late this evening. I arrived around 8:10 or whatever, and the last guy had gone, closed down the station and gone home. So I go in, and I have my script there, and I'm just reading over it, got the mic on, and just working away, and rehearsing, going back and forth. And as you're rehearsing a read, a voiceover read, you know, you're cursing to yourself, and go, ah, anyway, but 20 minutes into this recording, someone walks into the studio, walks in, goes like this to me, pulls the fader down and said, the last guy didn't turn the transmitter off. You've been on air for the last half hour. Luckily, I was on my own, so I was talking to myself. But yeah, I was trying to remember what I'd said, you know. Anyway, jeez. Hilarious. Yeah. So the whole of Bray was listening to me rehearsing my my ad.
Yeah. I mean, it's strange at times. I mean, the way things are now. When we were on air, this is the early 80s, we had one thing that was there'd be no swearing on air. Remember that?
Yeah.
No presenter was allowed to swear. And if they did, there was hell to pay. Because it was things like that that could get us taken off air. Mm. Stupid things. Mm. And that was one of the rules. I mean...
It was unnecessary to have too many rules, because I think in the sense that we were, like I said earlier, we had this kind of professional approach to things. I don't know where it came from, but I mean, I think you and I would have wanted careers in radio, I suppose. We didn't get them.
No, we didn't.
But, and lots of pirates did become, you know, RTE presenters when 2FM came on air. Dave Fanning and Jerry Ryan and Brian Dobson, who's here today. They're all ex-pirates, you know. There's lots of them. I meet them all the time in my business. But so we wanted to do the right thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and part of that was no bad language and doing things correctly and trying everybody to pass that on to other guys then as
well. Yeah, I think everybody wanted to do a good show.
Yeah, they did.
Because the standard was good.
Yeah, it was high.
Whoever you were listening to, they would, whether you liked the music or not, just the production and how they done the programme would be top class.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
that's true. Yeah.
So everybody wanted to keep that going.
Mm.
Be it rock and roll or classical, they were all done really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.